Welcome to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud, available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Pandora. Or head on over to the website AmericaOutLoud.com and check out the articles and podcasts. And please share those on social media. Thank you all for joining us on this Veterans Day, where we have a special show for you. We will be joined by New York Post journalist Heather Robinson to discuss her recent article where she talked to 13 World War II veterans. We are very excited to talk to her. Veterans Day is a day to be proud of our great country and thankful for all the great sacrifices and the great men and women that have made our country so special. Growing up, my grandpa Everett was deaf the entire time I knew him after losing his hearing serving in a USS LST during the Battle of Leyte Gulf in World War II. He never once complained about it, and he is really a hero of mine. I'm excited for the show tonight, but first off, how are you doing, Rob?
I'm doing good, Andrew. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in tonight. Would also like to wish all those veterans, I hope you had a great Veterans Day. Veterans Day, not to be confused with Memorial Day, whereby in May we honor those soldiers who had served and are now no longer with us. Veterans Day is where we honor those soldiers who have served and are still with us, the sacrifices that they made. Many of my cousins and uncles were veterans and are veterans. You know, I often think about the sacrifices that these men and women, brave men and women, made in order that we might have our freedoms here today. And I wonder if those individuals who don't like the country are appreciative of the services of these men and women. Because if it wasn't for their services and their families, we wouldn't have so many freedoms that we have today, that we take for granted, unfortunately. And to just going to looking at Heather's article, I think a majority of those that she interviewed were centurions or hundreds. I mean, they were the greatest generation, the ones that served in World War II, I think it is. And, you know, I'm always astounded by the act to serve. What in that person would give that drive or that courage to say, I want to serve my country? Just recently, we were congratulating Winsome Sears, who just won lieutenant governor in Virginia. She was a Jamaican. And before she became a U.S. citizen, decided to enter the armed forces and serve this great country. And during her acceptance speech in Virginia, Winsome Sears said that the country had done so much for her that she was willing to die for this country. I think this is a Black woman that said this, while others were attacking her, I mean, with all kinds of derogatory comments. And I thought, wow, I wonder if they have served or would serve. No, not one of them has served. I doubt they would serve. But she served this great country, and to say that she was willing to die for it. The other day we had on the show Colonel Julie Hall. 30 years of her life, she served in the military. Joe Kent served in the military. I mean, these are amazing patriots who would go and serve knowing that their life, they're putting their life in harm's way. But yet and still, the call to serve, to honor this country. Whereas there are others that just, you know, completely unappreciative. And, you know, they take advantage of all that life has to offer and they complain. But if you were to ask them to serve, I doubt they would do it. They would probably look the other way. They say, who are you talking about, me? Joe Collins, another patriot that was on, he too served this great country. And the list goes on and on and on. Amazing patriots and their families to honor the call to duty. It's phenomenal. So when I saw Heather's piece that came out the other day, I remember her talking about it in that she was putting together this article and she was looking for veterans to interview, because a lot of them that served in those wars they're gone. And then to see that she was able to put this piece together, 13 soldiers, as you said, Andrew, veterans. Some were men, some were women, a Native American, a Black American, white American. The piece was incredible. And then the advice that they were giving to young Americans. And I'm sure she'll talk about it, but all of it was along the same lines of, you know, we have the greatest country. We're not perfect. We're not the perfect union, but we're striving to get there. Be thankful. Be appreciative. You might not like everything about the country, but to go out and say, oh, America is just horrible, and this is the only country that you've ever lived in. Think about it. This is the only country they have ever lived in. Many of them haven't even gone outside of the state that they live in, let alone the town. But they could say, oh, this is a horrible country. Oh, really? Compared to, you know, where would you want to go? And wherever it is, maybe we should get you a ticket and send you there. But these soldiers that served, they were all appreciative. And I'm sure that they went through many things in their lives. You think about the women that had served during that time. It was before women's rights, and I'm sure that they struggled with some of the things they had to go through. You look at the Black Americans that served. I think there was a Tuskegee Airman, the things that they had to go through, the Native American. But yet and still, they look at this country and say, it is the greatest country. Because we have freedom, we have our rights, and you can do whatever you want to do in this great country if you apply yourself. And heck, even if you don't apply yourself, you still get to live in the greatest country in the world. And as one of our guests said, it's the luck of the draw. You won the lottery when you were born here in America. So, Heather, how are you tonight?
I'm terrific. Thank you.
So, Heather, what made you decide to write this great piece?
Well, I had an influence in my life, Rob, a new love in my life, actually, who, you know, he is very, very deeply interested in World War II. He took me to World War II weekend in Reading, Pennsylvania, which is a celebration, a acknowledgement of World War II that happens every year. There are recreations. There are also veterans, you know, who are there to talk about their experience. And I saw that some of these vets, they are centenarians close to or over 100 years old. And I was so struck by the living history that these ancient warriors who were still there talking about their experience. And I was striving to hear them and to understand them, but it was a little hard to get close enough because so many people were there. And I found myself intrigued and wanting to know more. And so that's how the idea was born. I proposed the story to my editor at New York Post weekend, Margie Conklin, and I thought of writing it for July 4th. And she said wisely, you know, Heather, this is a bigger project. I think this is more of a Veterans Day project. But if you really want to dig into it and you want to find a range of veterans, you know, then yeah, then she greenlit it. And so I had the task of finding still living veterans of that terrible and, you know, great war who wanted to speak to me. She wanted a range of branches of the services. I learned that there was no Air Force yet in WW2, so it would be Army, Navy, Marines. There were pilots, however. They were Army pilots or Navy pilots. And she also wanted a range in terms of diversity, racial diversity. And of course, the service was segregated then, unfortunately, but there were different units that Black Americans and other minority Americans served in. So so I did a lot of research, a lot of legwork. And I, you know, I had help from some people, including my boyfriend, frankly, in locating the point people to talk to. And the World War II Museum in New Orleans was a great resource, and others. And it took a lot of old fashioned sort of legwork, Rob, you know, to find the folks, because as you said, sadly, you know, we're talking about 80 years since the start of that war, which means that a lot of those people who fought, who saved the world for us are gone now. So it was really a you know, a history project kind of, and a journalistic project to find those who are still here. And of course, you know, I couldn't interview everyone. There are many, and it kind of haunts me that there are others out there who I haven't spoken with. And this may be among our last opportunities to hear from them. But I found those I could in the time frame I had.
Right. Well, it's phenomenal that you were able to find them, like you said, because, I mean, who knows how much longer they would be here. And mm-hmm. Andrew, I want to say to you, you know, thank your grandfather for serving. And as you said, as long as you've known him, you know, he didn't have his hearing. So, I mean, that's one thing that I never knew about you, that your grandfather had served. And we've spoken about the war on so many occasions, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, he passed away about 10 years ago, but I was always super proud of his service. He didn't always like to talk about the battles and whatnot he was in. He actually was in the Battle of Leyte, which is the biggest naval engagement in world history, and that's where he lost his hearing. But yeah, just all these heroes, these veterans, what they sacrifice, it's just truly incredible. Heather, you mentioned the 13 people that you interviewed. Did this ever feel like a task that would be hard to fulfill? Because it has been 80 years, and it's so hard to find these great veterans that are still with us today.
Yes, Andrew, it did. I was very nervous after I pitched the story and my editor wanted it. I then felt a lot of trepidation because it wasn't so easy. I started with the veterans' hospitals and with the, you know, the Veterans Administration in Washington, D.C. and other organizations. And in many cases, I wasn't hearing a lot back. And I was hearing, you know, that people didn't feel well, people were sick, there was nobody. And so it particularly because I also wanted a range in terms of diversity, in terms of the different battles they fought in, the different branches of the service. Yes, at times, you know, if you'll allow me to make a little joke about it, it was almost like, you know, dating in your 40s. It's kind of like, you know, you want to think about who's available. I mean, you know, there aren't that many people available, and a lot of those who are available have certain issues, and you know, you have, so you know, you need somebody who's you know, still with it enough to be able to converse. And so you don't want to, anyway, but yeah, it was a challenge. A lot of it was through word of mouth and through people who are passionate about the study of WW2. Once Dave, my boyfriend, put me in touch with the man at the World War II Museum and a couple other museums, I was able to contact people that way. That was a big help. I learned that, for instance, because the military was all male then, the women who served were not official members of the military, but there were these incredible, courageous units of women. One of them was called the WASPs, the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, I believe they were called. Let me see if I'm getting the acronym right. I have my stories right here. Oh, the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. They freed men up for combat duty by taking over the civilian flying jobs here in the U.S. So who knew about this? There were thousands of women in their late teens and early 20s who either had pilot's licenses or learned to fly, and they did a lot of very vital work to help the military. 60 some of them, I can't remember the exact number, lost their lives doing this. So they were very much soldiers, even though they weren't officially acknowledged at that time to be part of the U.S. military. So that was an example of something I learned about. And through the museum for the WASPs in Sweetwater, Texas, I located Nell Bright, who's 100 years old, who was a pilot, who was a soldier in that service. She towed targets so that men could learn to hit the targets. Basically, she had a very dangerous job over the desert. She and other, these were young women in their teens and late teens and early 20s. And so things like that I learned, and I found people through museums, through different interest groups online, through there was a photography studio in Pennsylvania that helped me find the man who now is on the cover of the story, Charles Shea. He was a medic, and he's Native American, as Rob mentioned. So it was really through a different combination of networking and online research and word of mouth that I found the 13.
So Heather, when you said that they weren't recognized as soldiers, I never knew that. Mm-hmm. And now, is there a museum in Sweetwater, Texas?
Yes.
Okay.
For the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. And actually, it should be acknowledged that even though I know we didn't like a lot of his policies, it was President Obama who acknowledged them and gave them the full military status, these women, that they didn't have for many years, certain kinds of benefits, things like that, they were not given because in those days, in WW2, the military the women weren't officially part of it. There was also on the naval side, and I interviewed a woman codebreaker. She was fascinating. Similarly, the Navy had a program called the WAVES, which was Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service. And again, many, many thousands of women in World War II. They were soldiers. They did very important jobs, but they weren't at that time officially given the full benefits of military membership, I guess. So it was kind of like, but this woman I interviewed, Julia Parsons is her name. She was a code breaker, as were others who were in the WAVES. Their work was incredibly vital. A lot of them were, very smart women who scored very high on aptitude tests. And that's one of the things I also learned as a side note is, and I think this is still true today, the military in a lot of ways, in some ways I think winds up being less discriminatory than other institutions, because if somebody shows aptitude for something, they don't care as much about the color of the person's skin or the sex. It's like, if you can do the job, the military wants you in that job. And so I think that that's part of what happened too. These special units were developed, not so much just to be inclusive, but because the military needed the talent, right, of these minority service members, these women, right, people who were good pilots, who could be code breakers, And so everybody was all hands on deck to win the war. And so, later on in the war, these special units were developed, not to be nice or something, but because these were talented people and, the country needed them.
Well, Heather, we had Colonel Julie Hall on our show, and what you're saying, she said the exact same thing, that it wasn't about inclusivity. It was more so there was a need. And so they would reach out to, or you reach out to those particular individuals. While we hear, well, not us, but some play identity politics. That's not what they're looking at. And she even made the comments about gays in the military. She's like, yeah, they're gays in the military. They've been there for quite some time, but we don't care. We're just looking at, can you do the job? You can do the job, do the job, and make certain that you get back home. Do your mission. You have a mission to do, fulfill the mission, and then you come back home and you protect the other person that's alongside you. So yes. I think that as of lately, we've become so, and I hate to use this word, woke. So many people have become woke that we've lost our way. But in looking at reading your article, and it's a phenomenal piece, and I would encourage everyone to pick it up and to take a look at it. What is the title? Give us the title.
The headline is The Wisdom of Heroes.
The Wisdom of Heroes. And we could definitely use a lot of wisdom from heroes. Now, Andrew, something else I didn't know about you is that you are a World War II sort of buff. You like to, read up on it or study it. Again, going back to your grandfather, who unfortunately, like you said, he died 10 years ago. So what did you find interesting about this piece by Heather?
It was just incredible that she was able to find this many World War II veterans that were coming out and still wanting to speak. You look at our current president, he's a great deal younger than these guys, and these guys to still have the mental capacity to want to come out and talk about America and what they went through. It's just amazing to me. Now, Heather, one of the things I always found most interesting about World War II is how it was just a total team effort and the entire country came together. Did any of these people you interviewed still have spouses that were alive that mentioned how it was here at home? Because I mean, we've seen movies like League of Their Own, which I think do serve a good historical purpose, but it wasn't just baseball and women playing that. It was, they were working in factories and picking up the slack here at home. Did you hear from any of them spouses about what it was like here at home?
Well, what a sweet question, Andrew. What a lovely question. And I wish the answer was yes, but these folks really are quite ancient, you know, and so they're about 100 years old. And as I don't recall any of them having a living spouse, you know, sadly, but I actually, several of them spoke to me about their spouses. You know, one man in particular, Paul Cohen, went on at great, great length about his beloved wife, Frances, and he's pictured in the story holding a photo of them together when they were younger. He just adored her, and he went on at so much length about, it was really cute how she would dance with other guys at the USO, and everybody wanted to dance with beautiful Frances, but she was going home with him, and so he didn't mind. But I'm trying to think if, you know, in terms of what another gentleman, Joseph Donna from Johnstown, PA, who is an amazing man who I had the privilege to interview in person. He spoke about his late wife, Marie, who was a code breaker. And he told me a little bit about how she wanted to get married and before that I don't think they got married till after he returned, but he had a really cute anecdote to share about how he and the other guys, they were only like 19 years old on this ship, the USS Suwannee, which saw 14 battles. It was a Navy aircraft carrier providing escort to ships that were supporting the Marines on Guadalcanal. And he was in the Battle of Leyte, like your grandfather, Andrew. That's where his ship was hit by a kamikaze pilot. Anyway, he talked about how on the ship for all those months, they would hear Tokyo Rose, which was a Japanese propaganda broadcast, which tried to demoralize the troops. And they Tokyo Rose would say, boys, you know, and he did the voice. Do you know what your girlfriends and wives are doing now? And Joe said he would always think to himself, I hope she's having more fun than me. So
that's cute.
Yeah, those were the anecdotes I remember about the spouses. And I'm trying to think if I remember any others. This was interesting. Julia Parsons, the codebreaker, told me she was really sharp and quite a feminist. She spoke about how she had wanted to be an engineer. She went to Carnegie Mellon, which was Carnegie Tech in those days. But that pathway, she felt, was not open to her as a woman. And she aced an aptitude test and was recruited to be a WAVE and tapped for the decoding code breaking unit. And she talked about how she couldn't tell anyone, her boyfriend at the time, who eventually became her husband, her parents, her friends. There she was, this, I guess, like 20-year-old girl. And she was doing this top secret classified work, working with the Enigma machine, which was an incredibly, I don't even have the mathematical mind to begin to understand, much less explain what it was, but it was something the Nazis had developed to encode messages more securely than like anything had ever been encoded. But the Allies were able to find one of these machines on a submarine that was wrecked and eventually work with what they found to decode the German, the messages the U-boats were sending to sink our ships. And anyway, the bottom line, as far as the spouse was, that Julia said she had to tell her boyfriend she just had like a secretarial job. And that's what everyone thought until like 60 years later or something. And one day she said, I told my husband one day and he was all annoyed. And I said, oh, yeah, he felt all betrayed. I said, that would be ridiculous. What difference does it make now? It was 70 years ago. So, you know, he never knew she was like this code breaker. Nobody knew. She took the imperative so seriously to not tell anybody that she didn't tell anybody for like 50 years, even her husband. So I thought that was interesting.
Very interesting. Thank you so much, Heather. You're tuned into After Dark with Rob and Andrew, available on America Out Loud via iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the America Out Loud app to keep track of all the great shows. We'll be back with more from journalist Heather Robinson on After Dark with Rob and Andrew.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
It was a vision that gave birth to a unique multimedia platform that would combine classic talk radio, great writers, and memorable podcasts and videos. AmericaOutLoud.com is a conservative leader in a field that is predominantly run by far-left progressive globalists. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
And we're back with After Dark with Rob and Andrew. And our guest tonight is journalist Heather Robinson. And Heather is joining us to talk about the piece she recently wrote for the New York Post, Wisdom of Heroes, whereby she interviews 13 veterans, American patriots that had served in World War II. They're still around. And we're thankful that they're here and that she was able to reach out to them. Because I remember, as I said, when she decided to take on this assignment and she reached out to Andrew and I and asking us if we knew of any soldiers that were still around. We did our best to see if we could find any, but we were unable to. So just listen to her tell her story. I mean, she started writing this, I think, was early spring, and now it's to completion. And she was successful in finding some patriots that are still around today. We honor those patriots and so many more that are out there, and those whose families had soldiers that are no longer with us. So, Heather, great job in getting this piece, you know, getting this piece out there. I mean, like I said, it's a great piece. So just looking at the story and the some of the words of wisdom that these great patriots had, what do you take away from it? How did it, did it change you in any way, your perception of our soldiers?
You know, I think it did, Rob. I mean, I always had respect, of course, for our service members. As a Jewish American, for one thing, I've always felt a special gratitude toward our service members. And these particular folks, WW2 veterans, let's face it, they saved the world for us. I mean, I respect all our vets, you know, but without these people, we'd all be, I don't know whether we'd be at all. I mean, we know that they were facing a hellish, fanatical set bunch of enemies. There was no alternative to fighting this war. And, you know, I think there's a kind of clarity in that, which I don't think it means they deserve more respect than our other vets, but I think it's easier to celebrate the victory. It was a cleaner, more clear-cut victory. It was, you know, than others have been. It was an indisputably necessary war that they fought. They were, America was forced into it and had to win it. And as you said earlier, Rob, it was all hands on deck. There was unity, there was conviction and clarity of purpose once the country did enter the war. And I think that the character of this generation of people, I mean, I'd heard the term greatest generation many times, but I think it's more than a cliche for me now. I think I get it on a deeper level, having spoken with them.
Really?
So much humility, so much grit and toughness in these people. No self-pity, you know, just a sense of they did what they had to do. And I relate to what you said, Andrew, when you said your grandfather didn't really want to talk about the battles. I encountered that, you know, throughout this project. The humility and the sensitivity of these people, some of them had to do some pretty grisly things, you know, and I did read about it some and I talked to them a little, but they didn't glory in it. They didn't want to celebrate the killing, you know, they didn't take it lightly. I had the sense that it was something that really left its mark on them. Those of them who were in combat in particular, it was hard for them to do it. They were the opposite of people who were in a hurry to go and, you know, engage in bloodshed. They didn't want that, but they did what they had to do. You know, as one of them said, I'll quote him, Chuck Meacham, he was one of Carlson's raiders. He was a Marine raider. On Okinawa and Imorau and Guam. And, you know, he had to endure grueling physical conditions. He sent me, in fact, like a 60-page write-up about his service. He told me he wouldn't speak to me until I read it. He was a really tough older guy, you know. And, you know, his quote was just, to fight was our duty, and we did the best we could. You know, and I'll tell you what, They did great. They saved us.
And you look at today, at our soldiers today, and not to say that they want to talk about what they did, but we've almost like made them out of heroes, and we showcase them, and we talk about, oh, well, this person did this, whereas these soldiers are reserved. They don't want to talk about it. They did their job. And that was it. And Andrew said the same thing about his grandfather. I mean, to just imagine what they saw at such a very young age.
Yes.
Boys, yes. Girls, yes. Out there at the forefront. Now, you know, we've had war before. We have the Gulf War. You have the like 30-year plus war in Afghanistan, which, you know, Biden ended horrifically, but, you know, we won't go into that. But these soldiers, they're humble. They're reserved. Mm-hmm. We talk about them every so often.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that many of them aren't with us. And before long, those that did serve weren't with us. So you hear that the greatest generation and what it took, the sacrifices, mm-hmm. the women were back at home, as Andrew said, they were holding down the fort. They were going into the factories. That's when women were entering into the workforce. You know, they had Rosie the Riveter, you know, and she was out there getting it done.
Yes.
And as Andrew said, they came together. We came together as a nation. We weren't perfect then. We had segregation. We didn't have women's rights. But yet and still, we came together.
Very true, Rob. And I had such a strong sense of both of those big ideas you just articulated so beautifully. The unity was something that I think that they all felt, you know, and there was also, I mean, I talked to three Tuskegee Airmen, actually, who were in the story, and, you know, all Black men and one Native American man. The airmen were pilots, of course, and, you know, what happened there was I had been really, you know, eager to speak to a Tuskegee Airman, and then kind of when it rained, it poured, because it took a little while, but when the national director got back to me, he had several people interested. And so, you know, I was very blessed to, you know, be able to interview several. But anyway, there was Johnny Jones, who was the second Black Army warrant officer in the United States Armed Forces. And their perspective, I would say, if I can sort of combine them a little, because of course each had a different individual perspective, but one takeaway that I did notice from theirs and from the Native American medic, Charles Shea, those five men they had a somewhat different perspective, I would say. I think that they had more criticisms of the country based on the segregation and the prejudice that they endured, but each one of them, I would say, in his own way, found a way in the interview to express a love of the country, for the country. Very strong love, strong as any of the love, you know. It was just, there was an acknowledgement, like Johnny Jones, the warrant officer, said to me, you know, that he had, you know, he was in charge of managing all the belongings of many, many of the soldiers at D-Day, his fellow soldiers, you know, making sure that, and equipment and supplies. He had a massively responsible job involving organizing enormous amounts of information and personal effects. And he was injured badly in the third wave at Normandy when his ship was bombed and he was thrown up into the air. And, you know, basically what he said is that he was proud to serve, you know, but that he had forgotten about segregation while he was serving. And that when he came back, he heard, "Go to the back, boy," you know, in the South. And he said he felt like sometimes blowing some heads off, you know.
But I saw that. I read that piece when he said that he felt like blowing, but yet and still that humility, when he closed it out, that piece, it still came back to the unity and the love of the country. I thought, wow.
And a dedication to changing things for the better. Yeah. And he became an attorney, and he was he represented the architects of the Montgomery bus boycott, which preceded Martin Luther, he represented the architects of the Baton Rouge bus boycott, preceding the Montgomery bus boycott, which was Martin Luther King's protest. So he really was a force for change. And I inferred from what he told me that a lot of the skills he developed in the Army, he then brought to bear in his legal career. He became a state representative in Louisiana as well. So he really turned his anger into action,
right,
positive action. So that positivity, you know, I thought was a thread that, you know, ran through all of these people.
Right.
You know, I think that that's something that we need more of today.
Oh, yeah. I often hear people say that had served in the military, Black Americans, and how they went to the military and they served. And then when they returned home, especially in the South, and to be treated the way they were treated, yeah, and it thought like, wait a minute, I just fought for this country. I shed blood for this country. And this is a treatment I'm going to get, but yet and still they persevered. And you look at the country where we are today, again, we're not perfect and we still have issues and we're trying to make this a perfect union. But again, I take my hat off to those soldiers for what they did. And, you know, and the gloaming of their lives as they, you know, reach the final chapter, as they're able to, you know, look back on it, and then you to recognize them by writing this piece to tell their story so that we could see it through their eyes, the good and the bad, but yet and still here we are today. Like I said, you look at the women and they weren't even recognized as soldiers. And you look at women today, I look at Colonel Hall, who is a colonel. And can you imagine, Dan? They would have never thought of that. But some years later, look at how much this country has grown and advanced. I mean, we're still growing. We're still trying to get there, while there are others that want to drag us back and push us back and bring up all of this hateful stuff. We recognize the shortcomings of the country, but we also recognize the good in the country. And it is the greatest country in the world. And when you're born here, you hit the lottery because there are so many other people that want to come here. Do you see Americans fighting to go to a European country? No, you don't see that. But you do find Europeans that will come here and give up their citizenship to be an American. And if they're not giving up their citizenship, they're coming here to live. Look at Prince Harry, he and his wife, they're here, you know, and Europe is just as free as we are, so to speak, but yet and still they're coming here. And then you look at so many other people that are coming here. If they could just get their feet on our soil, regardless as to all the division that a lot of people said we have, and we do have there, you know, we have our challenges, but not at the level that many people want to pretend that it is. Because if it were at that level, do you think we would have so many people knocking at our doors, trying to come in legally and illegally? It is without a doubt their greatest country, thanks to those men and women that you interviewed that are still here with us today. So I'm glad we were able to recognize them. We're able to recognize them through your article, the great article that you wrote. And then you're able to memorialize it on pen and paper so that other generations can go back and look at it.
Oh, thank you, Rob. Thank you. That's so, so validating and wonderful of you. And I, you know, you are a person of so much character, and you too, Andrew, I appreciate your appreciation. You know, I mean, to be honest with you, sometimes it's a little frustrating because, I mean, this was such an honor to do, and I would like to see their stories get broader reach, not just for myself, but because these are such, they are remarkable, and they are our predecessors, people who've enabled us to live the lives we're leading. And sometimes when I look at what becomes trending, what people are fascinated by, you know, I get a little dismayed to see that the popular sort of imagination is so focused on just ridiculous stories sometimes.
I mean, like the Kardashians.
and negativity in general, and you know, I mean, but so it's wonderful that there are people like you guys who grasp, you know, that there are heroes among us.
Right. And so So Heather, answer this. How much of your time did this take from you? Because, you know, you're usually a regular on our show. We would have you on like twice a month to talk about current events, what's happening. But, you know, this time you're like, guys, I want to do it, but I'm working on this piece. So how much of your time did it take from your day-to-day life for you to focus and get this piece together?
You know, a lot, Rob. It's kind of been my life. I mean, not since the spring. I would say it started, you know, in the summer, because I pitched the idea for 4th of July, like a week before the 4th of July, which, you know, looking back, I'm chuckling that, you know, I thought I could turn it around in a week because it was more like 3 months solid of close to, you know, I don't know if I'd say full-time work. I am a freelance journalist. I did write a couple other pieces too, but it was really my main work for like 3 months, I would say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was spending a lot of time during many days. Just a big piece of the work was just finding the folks, you know, as I said, and a lot of emails and calls and old fashioned sort of shoe leather reporting. And then once I found them, of course, you know, the setting up and a coordinating of the interviews, which were a joy, but that took a little doing too, because many of them, some of them are actually still living alone, believe it or not, several of them.
Okay.
And that was challenging, but others have a family member, in some cases, a grandchild, which was really sweet. In the case of Alexander Jefferson, his granddaughter, and Woody Williams has 2 grandsons, and they, I think in some cases they kind of help manage their honored elderly relatives' media life, you know?
Right.
So in those cases, things went a little smoother as far as the arranging of the Zoom, et cetera. But yes, the interviews, and then fact-checking and coordinating the photos, I gathered most of the photos from the families, and that took some time. So yeah, you know, I've been working on this for months, and it's been a real honor, and you know, but not a quickie, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, what are the takeaways for you when you look at the soldiers then and now, mm-hmm. and those words of wisdom that they gave you? Mm-hmm. What are your takeaways from this, from the piece that you put together?
Well, I think they were similar to what you zeroed in on, Rob. Unity was a huge theme. You know, as Julia Parsons said, and I'll quote her, the code breaker, I said, "What is your advice?" And she was a little reluctant to offer advice. She just said, "Look, you know, people have to figure out their lives. All I can say is I just wanted to do something. Everyone wanted to do something, and everyone did. It's amazing what a country can do when people are united." So the unity, and then also love for the country, love and positivity and channeling your feelings of, you know, and again, I think they did. I think there was another takeaway I have to honestly say was I was dismayed to learn how much prejudice there was, Rob. You know, I mean, I know there still is some, but I share with you the idea that in many cases, I think our liberal friends and Democratic Party kind of amplify it for their own reasons sometimes. And, you know, but I think that in these days, in those days, there really was a lot. I mean, from what these people were, the kinds of people who tended to be very proactive, and obviously they were doers. They were not complainers, like for the sake of complaining. I mean, they were telling me about stuff that really, it was upsetting to me to hear.
Because that was the life. That was the way it was.
Yeah, it was, you know, a lot of racism.
Right.
I mean,
and I remember some just talking to some, you know, in my family, and some of them decided to enter the military because they said, "Hey, I will have a better life. It will be a lot better than, you know, being a civilian." Now, when they went there, they had like the segregated units for the coloreds and for this group or for that group. But still, they were there to do a mission, and they felt that I will have it a lot better. Now, when some of them, when they left the military, the ones that went up north, a lot of them felt that, hey, it was a different life than when they came back to the South. And as you said, they came back to the South, and it was just, you're just still a boy. You're just a Black boy, you know, mm-hmm. or a Negro, you know, and that was it. It didn't make a difference that they had served. It didn't make a difference that they had a heart or received some medallion. They did not care that old hateful ways still existed. And some of them moved up north. There was racism there, but it wasn't as so heavy or ingrained as it was in the South. And so many of my relatives, uncles or cousins that did serve, I heard that they left the South and they moved up north or to the West or the East, but any place other than the South because of the racism. Now, again, we look at society today, we are a whole lot better off because of their sacrifices, because of the things that they did so that we could get here today. So when I see people that are completely unappreciative, when I see young people that know nothing about the greatest generation, they know nothing about these wars, and then they want to spew hate and pontificate that this is a bad country, that we're evil, we're no good, and that we're full of racism, that we're walking up and down the streets, we're full of racism, and that white people, they're just racist just by the virtue of them being white. I mean, it makes me mad, but it breaks my heart when I read a piece like yours and I look at the sacrifices that they've made. Now, they can, I'm sure, the blacks there could tell you about racism. The women could tell you about, you know, women not having different rights. Whereas today, these people, it's all in their imagination, because I think what has happened is that they've heard the stories of other people and they've taken that on as if though they're living it. It's like, but how is that so when you look around you and you see black people that have money, you see black people that are educated, you see women that are in different jobs, you see women that are making it, that are, have businesses and they're corporations. Now, we're not where we want to be again. We aren't where we want to be, but we are a whole lot better off thanks to the sacrifices of people before us. And if we could just realize that and stop living in the past, remember the past or you're doomed to repeat it. But we've also got to look ahead and say, wow, look at what we've achieved. Look at where we are. Look at the races. Look at the people, you know, the people that are loving each other, that are working together. And you look at, as I said, Winsome Sears, who's a lieutenant governor of Virginia, whoever would have thought that, you know, but because of her political affiliation, no, they don't want, the media doesn't want to give her credit. You have a lot of black talking heads that don't want to give her credit. You look at Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, a black woman. Look at Colin Powell. Look at the levels of success that he was able to accomplish. He himself admitted that, yes, there was racism, there's racism, you know, but look at where I am today. I mean, and we have to take our hats off, again, to these men and women that served. I hope that from this piece, people are able to look at it and glean from it and find a lesson, read the piece and say, wait a minute, let me stop and be thankful. Because these guys, they paved the way. And what I'm saying that I'm experiencing, they were in the thick of it. They really got it. They got to see it up close and personal, but yet and still they went out to serve this country.
Yes. And you know, I thought of one other takeaway, Rob, which was even as these stories of, you know, the racism was very dismaying, and the anti-Semitism too, from what Paul Cohen
described. Oh yeah, we can't forget about the anti-Semitism, yeah.
But there were also, as is often, I guess always the case, when you listen to people tell their own stories, and it's not just about the platitudes, it's about, in each story, there was a range that not every single person that, you know, was a glaring anti-Semite or a racist bigot. I mean, all of these brave people found other people, you know, of other backgrounds to work with and grow with, even in these times that were not as advanced as ours in those ways. I mean, for instance, Johnny Jones described to me how, you know, I think he, just what I could sense of his character, and he was wonderful to talk to. You know, he's brilliant and he's confident and he's assertive. And he described how when he was initially in New Orleans when he was tapped to his post, and it was not a segregated situation. And then he was transferred to Charleston, and he was assigned to like a separate barrack from the other officers, and it was dirty. And he went to a general named General Duke, who was a scion of the tobacco family. And he said to him, "This isn't acceptable. I roomed with, the white officers, and we had no trouble. We had no problems, you know." And Duke wasn't able to desegregate the army, but he knew that this was wrong. And so he arranged for Mr. Jones to be in a boarding house, like a hotel. And they were friends. He would go and have lunch with them.
Interesting.
You know, and he knew he had a big, very responsible job. He obviously thought highly of him. So I guess, you know, it was an example of how even in this system, which really there really was systemic racism, then, mm-hmm. you know, there were still individuals who they transcended that. They right. didn't, you know, not every single person bought into it, or, you right. know, and so that was interesting. Thankfully, I was glad to hear that.
Right, you always have those who transcend it. They see that it's there. Again, it existed then, and it still does exist. And I think it exists now because some people are still trying to hold on to it, and they're trying to turn it around and bring it back under something completely different. But I hope and I pray that we're able to stand against it and rise above it all.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rob. Being born and raised in Illinois, and I think anybody who's been born and raised in Illinois would agree with me, you always take some pride and honor being in the state from the great Abraham Lincoln. And same thing carries over to being a Republican now. These people in history who have made such a positive difference for all of us, we thank them, and we thank all of our veterans here on this Veterans Day. If you guys want to go read a great article in what we've been talking about tonight, go to the New York Post, check out their search function, and search out Wisdom of Heroes, 13 World War II Veterans give advice to young Americans. You can also find that on Google. If you search Wisdom of Heroes, 13 World War II Veterans Give Advice to Young Americans by Heather Robinson, you will definitely enjoy what you read. Thank you so much, Heather, for joining us tonight. We really appreciate your time. And thank you all for joining us tonight on After Dark with Rob and Andrew. Check us out and all the other shows over at AmericaOutloud.com. You can also find America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you download your podcast. We'll see you guys next time. And remember, stand for something or you will fall for nothing.